You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
Beach Boys. Nine minutes after 9 o'clock here on a Wednesday hump day, and joining me for a little discussion about history is Philip E. Smith. I'm not sure why I remember your middle initial, but I do. P. E. Smith. What's the E stand for?
Eugene.
Eugene.
Yep.
All right, Eugene. So, Phil joins us this morning, and Phil, retired Marine Colonel. He and I served together at the basic school for probably about maybe a year or two together, and then we were briefly at IOC together teaching. I show up while he's leaving and got a chance to turn over and spend some time with he, Lou Caprotta, Jody Osterman, John Rescher, and those guys as they left, as they walked out the door that summer. So I would tell you that Smitty is a, probably like me, is a lover of history, and that's probably where we both started as young guys reading history. And where did your love for history, just something you gravitated to as a kid? Anybody nurture it?
Well, it wasn't nurtured by my family. However, you know, it started in high school. And I think part of it was because of the church that I was associated with. The pastor was a former military, and he used history a lot in explaining a lot of Christian and spiritual principles. So I kind of had decided my junior year, early senior year of high school, that I was going to join the military. But in high school, I actually wrote a couple of papers. I was very interested in Napoleon. Wrote a couple of papers actually in high school on history, and then soon after that, that my interest in the Civil War sparked as a result of that. And the largest part of my library that I have, anyway, is mostly a Civil War history. And I have the interest that I had in the Civil War started purely from a military perspective. Of course, anybody who studies military history is eventually going to be asked questions about the political and the philosophy and the strategic questions that give rise to the military tactics, which were the original interests that I had in the Civil War. Come lately here, those types of things are not nearly as important as what seems to be the angst about some, that the Civil War was all about slavery, it was all about white supremacy, it was all about white nationalism, and that is not the history that I am familiar with at all. I know there are historians who try to make the case, but I have tried to take at least a middle road perspective on the political aspects, because I think a lot of people abuse the history by looking back from a time today and try to impose what we know happened on a period of our history where we didn't know what was going to happen, and that we presuppose and assume a lot of things away, which you can't do in history, which means if you're I'm not necessarily a real historian or a true historian. I'm kind of quasi, and I dabble in it. But if you're a real historian, you present the history from the perspective of the guys that were there at the time, and not presuppose, you know, 21st century politics, strategy, reasoning, philosophy back onto them. You have to kind of understand it, you know, from their perspective. And so I've tried to do that, and the books that I've read, I think, are tried to be somewhat neutral, although most of the books that I started out were kind of all about, you know, Jefferson and Lee and Jackson, just because from a tactical perspective, these guys were just kicking ass and taking names, and I was interested in finding out, you know, how can that be? And why is it important for tacticians to study you know, winners and losers both. And there's just something to be gained from all of it. But now we're losing all of that, I think, because we're assuming a particular philosophy and a particular way of thinking that these folks had back in, you know, 1860 that I just don't think was there at the time.
You know, one of the interesting things I think is and, you know, is my introduction, when you're stationed in Quantico, and I always had, an interest in the Civil War. So being that close to the battlefields was interesting. And so I enjoyed, you know, kind of doing the driving tour of these places that I had read about since I was a kid. Then the more I taught, and in particular, the more I studied decision making, they became these incredible laboratories for being on a battlefield and looking at decisions that people made under stress. And the cool part about the Civil War is they both wrote in English. They both wrote a lot after the war, especially about the battles that took place in Northern Virginia and Pennsylvania. And so when you were looking to teach and put stuff together, you have this incredible reservoir of first-person accounts of what happened. And so it's absolutely phenomenal in terms of teaching. What you quickly run into, though, is, especially relative to the South post-Civil War, you find things in the Southern Historical Society papers. Well, then you have to kind of like, well, what were the Southern Historical Society papers? Why were they writing? You know, just like you do when you read anything, to include the Bible. What is the author's agenda? And it helps you understand because it gives it context. And so that's when you begin to see some of these controversies that arise after the war. The first one being, would the South even be allowed to put up monuments or memorials to their soldiers in what is now the United States? They were a defeated section of the nation in terms of an insurrection. Would the United States allow that? And I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, just as Grant's handling of Lee's surrender in Appomattox was, he didn't seek to humiliate him. Right, they didn't seek to humiliate Southern soldiers. Ultimately, not without debate, ultimately the nation decides, in order to bind the wounds of the nation and heal those wounds, that the South ought to be allowed to put up their memorials to their soldiers. Your thoughts on that, Smitty?
Yeah, I agree, and I think that there were quite a few folks from the North that agreed with that, that thought that way. And as a matter of fact, aren't there not some Confederate graves in Arlington? And it wasn't necessarily the Southerners who, you know, put them there. The Union, the United States, had to agree to put them there. So I think there was an effort to bring the country together by that way, because even though I think the Confederate soldiers had their rights to vote removed for a few years, it eventually was all restored. Lee was never convicted of treason for the same reason why Grant treated Lee the way he did. And Lee decided that he was not going to continue the war by guerrilla efforts and means, which would have been really ugly.
Right.
Which stands in strong contrast to Jefferson Davis, who never surrendered, probably would have tried to continue the war had he had an army to do so. But so I just think the, particularly after a civil war like that was particularly long and fought on our soil, that people, sane, common sense type of activity, thinking, prevailed.
But that decision to allow Southern monuments wasn't without a debate in the United States. It was, you know, many felt they were a defeated nation. They should not be allowed to do this and erect these things. And so, but again, most of us are oblivious to that, right? I mean, you're reading about the Civil War, and then you get into the post-Civil War period of the nation. The South is now adjusting to life without cheap labor. How does life go on? Does it go on? You have Nathan Bedford Forrest, who, I would tell you is one of the most interesting generals to study, because he personally kills 18 soldiers in combat. I don't know of another general officer that killed one. Forrest, he's credited with the saying, you know, first with the most. He was also a slave trader, and also after the war, there were issues relative to the northern occupation of Tennessee, and they formed vigilante groups to intimidate both black and white to stay in your lane. And out of that comes the Ku Klux Klan, and Forrest is attributed to that. So you have all of this swirling in post-Civil War America. How does the nation heal itself? And that was one of Lincoln's chief concerns going into his second term, that the war was winding down, and how would the South be reintegrated back into the nation? And so... So now what we see, Smitty, is any symbol of the Confederacy is a symbol of racism. How does the nation in 2017 deal with this, with a culture that I don't know is particularly interested in an intellectual exploration of the Civil War, post-Civil War, how the nation bound itself, the magnanimous terms, because as you said, the Civil War now is, I read Lincoln's letter to Horace Greeley, where he says, and the whole letter is very, very interesting, where he says, if I could save the Union and not, let me just read the last paragraph.
Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
Lincoln and Greeley are friends, obviously. He writes this on August 22nd of 1862 in the Executive Mansion. And first two paragraphs are pretty brief and you know, saying, I don't disagree with you. I don't use a dictatorial tone. And then the second paragraph is one sentence. As to the policy I, quote, seem to be pursuing, as you say, I have not meant to leave anyone in doubt. I would save the union. I would save it I would save it the shortest way under the Constitution. The sooner the national authority can be restored, the nearer the union will be to, quote, the union as it was, unquote. If there be those who would not save the union unless they could at the same time save slavery, I do not agree with them. If there be those who would not save the union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount objective in this struggle is to save the union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would do that. But what I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps save the union. And what I forbear because I do not believe that it helps to save the union. I shall do less whenever I shall believe that I am, then, whenever I shall believe what I am doing hurts the cause, and I shall do no more, I shall do more whenever I shall believe that doing more helps the cause. I shall try to correct these errors when shown to be errors, and I shall adopt new ones so fast as they shall appear to be true views. I have here stated my purpose according to my view of my official duty, and I intend no modification of my oft-expressed personal wish that all men everywhere could be free. Yours, A. Lincoln. And that's very much a part of Lincoln. People don't want to hear that, right?
Yeah. Well, they don't pay attention to that because of what he then does in 63, about a year later, after the Battle of Gettysburg, where he does the Emancipation Proclamation and does that whole thing. So they take that part of Lincoln, separate from what he was trying to do in the first part of the war, which was to save the Union. Of course, it eventually saves the Union, but he makes it, he tries to keep the economy and the philosophy of that economy in the South separate from what it was that he was trying to do, just like you quoted there in his letter. But eventually he has to make it about the economy of the South, which indirectly and in some cases directly is related to slavery. And he does that. And that is basically what turns the tide for him in late 63 and the beginning of 64, was going after the economy of the South, and that brought, in my view, at least from a historical perspective, the army down and the South down. Not to mention all the other logistics and industry and things like that the South just could not reproduce. But I think it was I don't necessarily think it was the smartest thing to do, but it won the war,
right,
by making it about the economy of the South, indirectly related to slavery.
And unfortunately, just remember, you know, he does this because he believes that it is a way to restore the Union. It is a way to keep both England and France out of this thing, and to isolate the South, and to win the war, and thus restore the Union. Now, it's interesting. Of the first 18 presidents, 12 were slave owners. Where does this whole thing, how do we do this, all right? Certainly, there's a story to be told here, because, you know, you see Stone Mountain, Georgia, right? Is there an accompanying historical, I don't know, display that you see that says, you know, in 1862, you know, X thousands of people were, of black Americans were slaves, you know, across the state of Georgia? How do we tell history completely? Okay. Or do we, watch what we've seen on TV and wait for the Washington Monument to come down, wait to Jefferson, who owned slaves, you know, so how do we do this?
Well, now we're talking education,
right.
What people know and what they don't know. And unfortunately, this is also a pet peeve of mine with regards to the state of affairs in American education, is the current education school system, both elementary, middle, high school, and graduate or college and graduate school, they are not teaching history as a neutral thing. They are not teaching both sides of history. Particularly in a lot of the universities, they are not teaching both sides, and they choose to pick and choose. So that is how it has to begin, because there's no way that you can take there is a way, but it's very hard to take a 25 or a 26 or a 30 year old who hasn't been educated in 12 years of elementary and high school and 3 or 4 years of college to take a neutral view on history, because there are two sides. In some cases, there are 3 or 4 sides to a complex historical situation, particularly if you take into account politics, government, economy, military, foreign, internationalism, so on and so forth. It's not just as easy as black and white. So that's what has to start. I think we have got to have a revolution in education, and I don't know if we are even capable of doing that anymore, because the current educational people, the educators, the bureaucrats, are all victims of, products of, a very one-sided, dark part of our history, and they think that in order for history to be righted and for it to be given its proper perspective, it has all the bad things that happened that in our history have to be completely turned on its head without complete understanding of the whole situation, political and so on and so forth.
So
I don't know how it's done other than education.
That's a bridge pretty far, though, because most places, I mean, for instance, I show that letter and those kind of things to my kids, and they look at it like, what? Lincoln said this? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and because in their head, I mean, they've been taught Lincoln freed the slaves, right? The great emancipator. Well, this doesn't sound like the Great Emancipator, though. Well, there was more to it than Lincoln freed the slaves, trust me. But I don't know that the nation wants to go there. Does the nation care to read footnotes? Does the nation care to have a fuller understanding? And not only of the Civil War, but the Southern grief for the thousands and thousands of young Southern soldiers that went off to war and never came home, from disease, from being killed, from dying of wounds. It was the greatest single, it was the most significant loss of life in American military history. And so how did they grieve? And were they allowed to grieve and memorialize the valor of the soldiers that fought for North Carolina? Should that not have been allowed? And so the study of that, the understanding of that, it's to me something that makes the nation, better. The tearing down of it, right, is reminiscent of what the Soviets do, right? when they rewrite their own history. So to me, I'm a fan of the amplification of, hey, what we're going to do is we're not going to demolish Stone Mountain. It is a constant reminder of the wrong-headed policies of some in this country. What we're going to do is we're going to construct an accompanying, area where you're going to see the cost of slavery, the human cost of slavery in Georgia. So you're going to see both, and you're going to get a better view of this thing that the nation fought over in the 1860s. I don't know. And then the next question is, so where does it stop? Does it stop? Should Mount Vernon be dismantled? Should Monticello be dismantled? Where does it go? And so, what do you think? Statue come down?
Well, no, I don't think so. I think, once again, I go back to this abuse of our history, the way that some do is they look at our history from the perspective of today, and they impose upon that time in our history values and things that we know now. You can't do that. So, the monuments existed because of a certain framework mindset that existed at the time. And like you had stated earlier, this was not just, in other words, the South just didn't decide to do this. They were permitted to do it because it was talked about and there was conversation about it. It's a historical perspective. I mean, in Gettysburg and Chancellorsville, there's monuments on both sides. It's not highly, uniquely, one side versus that side. It's, they're evenly, neutrally presented as this is what happened here. And that's the way it should be. I don't think they should be taken down. I don't think there should be a conversation about taking them down. There needs to be the conversation that you alluded to about why these things happen, so that we better understand them. The knee-jerk reaction of a society that's hooked on social media and with attention deficit disorder means that they're not interested in that. They're just interested in placating themselves, their immediate emotional, social, gratification and justification gives them the license to abuse our history. And I don't know how we protect that unless you've got some leader somewhere that says, this is not how we do these things. Monuments can come down, I think, after discourse and political and legal conversations have been had, but to have them come down at the hands of groups with attention deficit disorder and no understanding of our nation's history, that's just wrong.
Yeah, I agree, but it seems like that is what possesses our nation right now. But again, my question, I guess, when you see this stuff is, if you're going to take Lee's statue down, then why don't you take Washington's statue down? Why don't you take Jefferson's down?
Well, but I think the people that would answer that question would say, well, the approach. They had a different approach to slavery, both of those individuals, in a different time frame. They will probably tell you that Lee was more of a racist than Washington or Jefferson, although I think the history would actually, turn it around. I do think, since we're talking about, and you raised the issue of Washington and Jefferson, I think both of those individuals are on history as saying in writing that they had wished that they had solved the problem of slavery. And they were very close to doing it in the Constitution as well, but we didn't get around to it until, the 50s and the 60s. But had they had the courage to take care of it then, we may have still had a civil war, but it would have been probably a little bit earlier. It would have been handled at least legally and constitutionally. And we'd be in a different place today. But But yeah, I mean, there are some that are trying to equate, you know, Washington and Jefferson and the founding fathers, you know, with the Civil War in 1860. And of course, there are some that say that the Civil War was the second war for independence.
Right.
There is justification to, you know, that parallel and corollary.
Let me read you an email.
I don't know if they continue to, if we continue to allow that thinking to progress, and that, I think that's a logical conclusion. There'll be another march on Washington, D.C. from inside. From within. Can you imagine?
Yeah. Oh, no, I can. Email says this. Interesting discussion. I always enjoy the thoughtful discussion that I hear on this program about these kind of issues. You both seem to be knowledgeable in it. I think, though, asking politicians to behave in any way that's either reflective or far-sighted is a bridge too far these days. What you'll have is you'll have leaders that don't seek to put up additional context to show who this was, what they fought for, as well as the downside and the cost of that. They will simply harangue, be standing up for what they believe to be right, to be able to get on national TV, and then that will be it. I think asking them to be educated, far-sighted, is ridiculous. I'm sorry if you're like that. I think Mac is a very smart man. I love when people say stuff like this. Because he wants to disband the political parties. I say, let's do it. Where do we start? Speedy, have I told you about my constitutional reforms? I've told you about that, right?
No, I haven't heard that. Restricting the term limits and those types of things. But I don't think I've heard your latest.
All right. Well, let me give you. So there's another email, real quick. Mac, out of curiosity, off the top of your head, the total casualties in the Civil War were? Let's see. I looked it up, so I wouldn't know off the top of my head. Though the number of killed and wounded in the Civil War is not known precisely, most sources agree the total number killed was between 640,000 and 700,000. Total Union death.
We're talking children?
No. Sold combatants.
Total, okay, yeah.
Combatants. Union Civil War casualties. Combat deaths, over 110,000. Other deaths, 250,000. From all the diseases that were in those camps and whatnot. Civil War, Confederate casualties, 95,000 combat deaths, and 165,000 non-combat deaths. Pretty amazing. The bloodiest battle of the Civil War was Gettysburg, 50,000 casualties. And then after that, the Seven Days Battle had 35,000, Chickamauga 34, Chancellorsville 29, Wilderness 24, Antietam / Sharpsburg 22, Second Battle of Bull Run 24, Shiloh 23, Fredericksburg 18,000, and Cold Harbor over 18,000. So you can see, I mean, and our population wasn't anywhere near what it is today. So a huge part of communities was lost in the Civil War. And
yeah.
So anyway, do you want to hear my argument for?
Yeah.
So give it some thought. How would you modify the Constitution to make it work better today? And here's my modifications. Political parties are outlawed. The majority of the people that get elected to go to Washington, D.C. today are under the middle of the bell curve. However, when you draw a line down the center of the bell curve and you separate Democrat from Republican, you just empowered the flanks of the bell curve. Okay? So by removing the political parties and also by federalizing elections, in that you won't have to raise any money if you qualify to run, and we have to figure that out. That's a part of this that is problematic for me. everybody can't run. So how do you decide? That's the one thing parties do, is they call the herd and they bring candidates. So we have to find a way of doing that. However, once you become a candidate, for instance, for state senate, you'll be allocated $1 million. You can spend that any way you want. There will be there's a 4-month campaign season. There's 2 debates that will be televised either in your state or nationally, depending on what office you're running for. And you'll be expected to show up for those debates. You have $1 million to spend otherwise, and that's it. And we vote over a 5-day period, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, and then the election is done. You can go then to Washington, D.C. to do the work of the people. You're beholden to nobody. And so then, because there's no R or D next to your name, guess what? The majority under that bell curve believe the same things. There have to be minor policy modifications to make sure you have enough people to pass the legislation. But by and large, they go there believing the same things. Madison writes about it, right? And he warns us in Federalist Number 10 about factions, okay, about the danger of factions to democracy. Well, what we have now and what this attempts to remedy is a money, right, that buys elections. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, their primary attributes as candidates were name recognition and the ability to raise money. That is not what the democracy needs, okay? So that needs to be addressed. So by doing it this way, we address that. Also, I had a former senator on my show, and he said, you can't compromise anymore. The only thing that you get when you compromise is a guarantee that you will face a challenger in your own party's primary the next time you run. Now, that normally doesn't happen with incumbents, but dare you compromise, and you will be called a sellout. They will run the sound bites forever. And all you're trying to do is do the work of the American people. But that's where we are today. And the media has assisted in this scorched earth campaign. And he attributes it there. Back in the day, there was this thing called the Fairness Doctrine that said that if you use the public airwaves, you had to present both sides of an issue when you were doing opinion stuff. And so when that went away, Rush Limbaugh could come on, and then Sean Hannity could come on after that. And then, you know, the whole litany that gets us this polarized media. And when the idealized media is what, the McNeil-Lear NewsHour. Bright, articulate people, you know, having debating issues in a respectful way, footnoting arguments. Hello. But we're nowhere near that anymore. So that's my deal, right? Outlaw political parties. What do you think, Smitty?
Well, getting there would be the toughest part. I was just thinking, you know, to myself, to get to that TIF report, you're going to have some kind of a revolution, because you're not going to have you're not going to have any Republicans or Democrats agree to outlaw what keeps them in power.
Can't we do a national? Can't we do a national referendum? Is there a mechanism to get enough signatures on a petition to do a national referendum? I don't think there is.
No, well, no, not now. But it would take a while to convince. And once again, to turn people to think like that, they have to be educated.
Oh, there you go.
So
screwed on that deal.
They have to know stuff. They just can't emotionally. And culturally, you know, recognize that to be, you know, a good solution.
What do you think intellectually of the merits? Now, you could caucus with whoever you wanted to caucus with. So, you know, if you're elected from, let's say, Nebraska, You'd caucus with the farm caucus. You'd caucus with the dairy caucus. You'd caucus, you know, I mean, you would have different groups that you would be affiliated. The majority leader house, the majority leader office, we turn that into a garden, an indoor garden, okay? The minority leader, we turn that into an arboretum. And so that's the way it goes. What do you think?
We still have some representative way to let all these multiple issues bubble up. But how does anything get done then into law? How does turn into policy and governance?
Same way. What does the party contribute to that? Nothing. Except gridlock. So law would still be passed the exact same way, introduce bills. But again,
right,
because that artificial line is taken off the bell curve, the fringes become the fringes. They're screaming in the night. The majority does the business of the majority of the Americans. And there isn't this stupid gridlock. Hey, and you know, I know Secretary Mattis doesn't really want us to talk about it, but, you know, if something did happen to in North Korea, how does Marine Aviation answer that one? They can't get there. We're committed in Syria and Afghanistan and that region. We don't have the ass. They're not ready. And who did that? Sequestration? That would be Congress and the president? Year after year after year. It's ridiculous.
Well, I think it certainly has merit from both an intellectual and a practical standpoint as well.
Thank you.
But getting to the point of doing it away with it, there had to be somebody had to stand up and hold up a flag and say, "Hey, rally around me! We're going to change the political system." And actually, that's kind of what several of the fringe groups are doing.
Different message. I'd be remiss if I did not ask you. A very good friend of yours is now the chief of staff of the White House. What do you think?
That's pretty awesome. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know that he was asked two or three times for that job and he had turned it down. And I guess he had conferred with Mattis and Tillerson and several of his other buds about what would be the likelihood of his ability to, you know, bring some order to the White House, or at least to the staff. But I think it's pretty awesome. It's unbelievable. And I don't think there's anybody that's more prepared, both from a practical understanding how Congress and the presidency works, than John Kelly, just because I know he reads everything that he can get his hands on. And I just don't know of any of the politicians or the people that he's working with that reads nearly as much. And for those that, you know, are trying to be critical of him with regards to his not having experience in the political realm, you know, I've had these same types of arguments with guys in the military. And the only way that you get experience is you actually do it, and if you don't have the opportunity to do it, you read about it and you teach it. So John Kelly's read about it, and from that perspective, he has more experience than many of the politicians who are, you know, on the Hill these days. And he knows a lot of them as well, too, so that's...
I would submit to you that his time, he had... served twice in our Office of Legislative Affairs on Capitol Hill. He ran it the second time he was there. I mean, you pay attention. That's all politics, right? It's all getting to know people.
Yep.
It's all learning the game and how it's played. Kelly was there for 6 years on Capitol Hill doing that. He also, in his capacity as Leon Panetta's assistant, I mean, that is, yeah, you're the military advisor, but what you're talking about is the political realities of some courses of action, and you're in that conversation. So I don't know that Kelly, I think that's a hollow criticism of him when you scrutinize his career. And then I'll tell you, the other thing, you know, he's not afraid to do is he would pick up the phone with people he trusts and said, hey, make me smart about this. What don't understand? But I would tell you this, you can't keep the president from himself. His initial comments about this, I'm sure Kelly cringed, and then they attempted to clarify his comments on Sunday. That wasn't good enough. And then what did the president do first thing Monday? He got back to D.C., he met with the attorney general and the director of the FBI, and then he made a statement. That's Kelly right there. Kelly's trying to get out in front of this thing, but the president can be his own worst enemy at times, and often is. Trivia question. The youngest American killed during the Vietnam was how old?
I want to say 17.
15 years old.
15? Yeah, unbelievable.
Dan Bullock, PFC, United States Marine Corps, died at the age of 15 in 1969.
Bullock.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, so that means he had to lie about his age, or somebody believed that he was older than he was. City
was. Yeah, I'm looking at a picture
of
him.
That's crazy.
He doesn't look like he's 15. He looks like a grown man. He's a big guy. All right, Smitty. No, again, I just, these are hard issues. And I think the nation coming to grips with, the issues that the Civil War was fought about. And it wasn't exclusively about slavery. And you might want to do some reading to find out about the complexity of what Lincoln dealt with. And then after that, the nation trying to heal itself, how it had to come back together and how it allowed the South, again, the most costly war that the nation's ever fought, the American Civil War, how it allowed the South to grieve and honor its war dead. I think if you begin to go down that road and read that, then it makes for a better understanding. But as you said, in a world of social media and 140 characters, I don't know that anybody's interested in doing that. And I guess we'll stand by to see what our politicians do. And it will only get us one step closer to living with no political party.
Let's hope.
We could only hope. You know, and it's interesting because people intellectually that I've told that to, they're like, interesting. Because we are united under the bell curve. And there isn't much that separates a moderate Republican and a moderate Democrat. And you could clearly do all kinds of different issues from annual budgets to infrastructure because there's not that much that separates them. But there you go.
Yep. Push it, buddy. Push it.
but again, I would tell you this. I'm amazed at the number of people that tell me that there's going to be another revolution in this country. And they're not the militia guys either, okay, that are going out on weekends drilling, right? With a bunch of other dudes. They're not those guys. They're smart, experienced business guys that are veterans that say, I do believe that this country's broken and there's going to be, I had somebody tell me, we're going to understand why the Second Amendment was made the Second Amendment. After they guaranteed free speech, what was the second thing they put in there? And why do you think it was number two? Because they knew that unless they were armed, they would have suffered the tyranny of the British. That's why it's number two. That's why it's an important right in this country. You're like, whoa. Didn't know we were there. Didn't know we were there. But anyway. All right, Smitty. Good luck with the Yankee workshop.
Yeah, thanks, my friend.
All right. Thanks for doing this.
Sure enough.
There you have it. The one and only Phil Smith here on a Wednesday. A lot of different paths covered today. Email. Mac, just a quick comment. Listening this morning has made me think about all these issues. I'm not so much educated in post-Civil War history the way the nation came back together. I now understand a little bit about why those Confederate monuments are there. And that certainly makes sense. But I don't think without context anybody else understands that. And I think the people that put them up, the Daughters of the Confederacy, who were they honoring? Slaveholders? No, they were honoring their war dead. So my perspective has changed on the issue a little bit. As others have said, I appreciate your program. Looking forward to hear the comment on the Marine Corps coming on next week. We'll probably tape it. We may have to tape it over the weekend, so you'll hear it next week. But so we shall see. We're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap things up on a Wednesday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. If you missed this first part of the program, don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs at allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you, the Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum, it's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug, scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do. and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Email, Mac, are you kidding me? 15 years old? How the hell did that happen in the 60s? I'm just reading about it. Dan Bullock. Was killed in Vietnam at the age of 15. He's a PFC. He was killed in the vicinity of An Ho Combat Base, Quang Nam Province of South Vietnam. Part of Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment. Born in Goldsboro, North Carolina, he lived there until he was 12, when his mother died, and he and his younger sister, Gloria, moved to Brooklyn to live with their father and his wife. He had wanted to become a pilot and a police officer or a U.S. Marine. When he was 14 years old, he'd altered the date of his birth certificate to show he was born on December 21st, 1949. He processed through the recruiting station and enlisted in the Marine Corps on September 18th, 1968 as a member of Platoon 3039 at Parris Island, graduating from boot camp on December 10th, 1968. He arrived in South Vietnam on May 18, 1969, was assigned as a rifleman, 2nd Squad, 2nd Platoon, Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, stationed at the An Ho Combat Base. He was killed instantly by a small arms fire on June 7, 1969. Not even there for a month. During a North Vietnamese Army night attack, while making an ammunition run to resupply his beleaguered unit, he was 15 years old. After he was buried, his gravesite did not have a marker. In the year 2000, one was finally provided. On June 7, 2003, a section of Lee Avenue in Brooklyn, where Bullock had once lived since she was 11 years old, was named in his honor. Holy shit. Yeah, he didn't look like he's 15. His name's Dan Bullock. Wow. Have a great day. I don't know how you even participate in this discussion. You know, it's easy for me because I can control who comes on the program. But, you know, the people I see on TV, it's like off the hook crazy. You can't even have a conversation about it. I will tell you this, though. The First Amendment is a big deal. The police in Charlottesville, it's their job to protect the public, guarantee the right of free speech. And the people who would attempt to thwart that, you're supposed to keep them separated. That's a right guaranteed by the Constitution. Troubling. Final email, entitled Surreal Times. New York Times reporter Cheryl Gray Stolberg originally reported about the, quote, hate-filled violence of both sides. She has since been beaten into submission and has written a correction to her original story. I watched CBS and Fox News last night. Nobody seems to be interested in reporting facts. Of course, Trump's inability to articulate at this point gives fuel to the fire. It was said General Kelly was standing off to the side with his head down. I hope he doesn't bail. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. This program continues right now, so don't touch your dial. Have a great one, and General John Allen joins us tomorrow.